Well, as the Chair City said earlier, this is the third talk in our series, What is the Sangha? And tonight, this talk is going to take us into a more specific area, quite directly related to our own lives and our spiritual development. We're going to be exploring the meaning of three terms: the individual, the group, and the spiritual community. And then we'll look at their relationship to each other and then how they relate to our spiritual lives. And this subject, particularly about the individual, Sangharaksha has given a number of talks on this topic since the late 60s, probably. It's kind of one of the central themes the FWBO, this theme of the individual and what is an individual and what is the individual's relationship to the group and to the spiritual community. It's really one of the most important ideas to understand in order to work with our conditioning and make spiritual progress, both individually and collectively. So I'll start with the individual. Sangharakshita has used this term to describe the kind of person it takes to tread the path of the Dharma. So at the highest level, it's a term he uses to describe, to define the Arya Sangha, those followers of the Buddha or followers of the Buddha Dharma who are in touch with the transcendental. But it's also a way of distinguishing between those who have awareness and spiritual growth as their practice and their aim, and those who do not. So the individual has a particular perspective about themselves and their relationship to others and the world and the group. They know that they can change and that they are becoming increasingly aware of their minds and hearts. This person understands that they are in relationship to others and to the groups, and to groups it's unavoidable, and that they can take responsibility for this relationship. They're not conformists who go along with the ideas of the majority of group members, and they're also not individualists who resist the ideas of others and set themselves apart. So they're not attached or dependent on the group, and they also don't seek their identity from the group. They're also not averse to the group or fear being swallowed up by the group. So there is a saying that Buddhists, and we could say individuals, are in the world but not of the world. We live in the world, we relate to the world, but we're not held captive by the world. And we're not held captive by the groups and organizations that comprise the world, in a sense. So we have these two poles along this plane. If we look at this circle as the group, there's these two poles that are in relationship to the group. On the one side are the conformists, and on the other are the individualists. And at a higher plane are the individuals, or sometimes what Bhante calls the true individual. So the conformists have a kind of passive relationship to the group. Maybe a little naive, too. That they find it easier just to conform to what the group is expecting of them. And on the other hand, the individualists might be said to be passive-aggressive, but they really don't like the group, but they're in the group. they're always kind of trying to assert their individualism not their individuality. Because actually, their approach is somewhat similar to the conformists in that if they didn't have the group, they wouldn't have their identity. And we're talking about the extremes there. And so they're adversarial. It's an adversarial relationship to the group. So they're dependent on the group in that way to have that stance. So, you know, most of us fall, you know, within one, there's a spectrum, and most of us would fall one side or the other of this or have these tendencies because of our conditioning. And the individuals really are aware of their condition, they work to rise above that conditioning and relate to the group in a different way. So this is what the individual is not. It's not a conformist, not an individualist. But then what is the individual? And how does the individual act? Well, individuals are their own persons. So they don't fear groups, and they don't need a group to define who they are. They take responsibilities for themselves. They know who they are. They think they can think for themselves. So they can respond to the group in creative ways. And they can also be receptive to others and sensitive to the others. They can communicate and participate in a straightforward way with honesty and clarity. And they can influence the group. And they're also receptive to other individuals in the group, as well as individuals who are not within that group. So if you have a group where all the members are individuals, or at least aspiring to be individuals, working to gain more and more awareness, then you have an effectively functioning collective or spiritual community, as the case may be. So I want to tell you about a little experience that I had in the late 70s. I was working in a small, collectively run workplace called New Ways to Work in Palo Alto. And there were eight of us, and we were experimenting with operating in a very different way. We decided that we would all share all of the tasks that needed to be done to run this organization. It was a counseling center, vocational career counseling center, but also promoted socially responsible work. So it had this very kind of political element to it. So there were clerical tasks, administrative, counseling, bookkeeping tasks that needed to be done. And so we all decided we would sort of rotate through those and try to set it up as a pure collective, and all the decisions were made by consensus. And we discovered that in addition to business meetings, we also needed to spend a couple hours a week processing our dynamic with each other since we were working in this way. And it was quite time-consuming as a staff, as you might imagine. And we realized that we had to kind of specialize, move more and more towards specialization because some of us lacked things like bookkeeping skills, for instance. But we did try to do most of the work collectively, and for the most part, it worked out. We were able to provide a service to the people who walked in our door anyway, and I think an effective service. And we were also, you know, modeling a new way of working, new ways to work. So we were able to do that for a couple of years before we sort of started to specialize more, and the staff grew, and it didn't continue to work exactly that way. But I really learned a lot about myself during that time, and it was quite a stretch and a challenge to my shy, passive tendencies. And I realized that that we as a collective, we're only limited by the limitations of each of us. And a lot of those limitations were limitations that we put on ourselves, you know, had to do with our views of ourselves and that kind of thing. So it was before I'd heard about, it was the very beginning of when I was a Buddhist, but I hadn't heard this distinction between the individual and the group and the spiritual community before. But later, I have since then reflected a lot on that experience and see that the collective only works when all its members are taking responsibility and stretching themselves beyond their limitations, i.e. being individuals. So I want to now look at what we've just been talking about in relation to, or in context to, in the context of the three fetters. In Buddhism, there are 10 fetters that must be broken before one can achieve, realize liberation or enlightenment. And the first three of these fetters, when broken, constitute what the Theravadins of the early Buddhists called stream entry, and what the Mahayanists call the arising of the bodhicitta. So when this happens, we're assured of progressing toward enlightenment without slipping back. That's why they call it stream entry, or in the current. So these three fetters, when broken, could say that a person who has broken these three fetters would be a true individual. And by the way, the three fetters are said to be broken all at the same time. And you might see that when you, as you hear about them. The first one is self-view, or having a fixed self-view. Most people don't really think that they can change. They intellectually agree with the Buddhist view of change. Deep down, there's this resistance, and we all experience it, to letting go of our identity as a certain kind of person. It's comfortable and familiar, and we can make excuses for ourselves by holding on to, well, this is just the way that I am. We have a view of ourselves in relation to the group as well, and the group reinforces that view of ourselves. We might have this view that, well, we are the one everyone likes, or we are the one who always causes trouble, or we are the one who makes people laugh, or we are the one who always avoids conflict, or whatever that view might be. We can say that, well, this is the way that we've been conditioned. But, you know, we know that, we know it intellectually, that it's possible to go beyond our conditioning. And once we've understood our conditioning, our practice is about breaking through into new ways of being and allowing our true nature to emerge. As Bhante says, the old self must die before real individuality can emerge. So if we aren't aware of ourselves, we won't break through. The second fetter is that of doubt, skepticism, or the inability to commit ourselves. So we really have this collection of selves, which results in our being indecisive sometimes, or making a decision to do something one moment and then the next moment another self will rise up and talk us into doing something else instead. We all experience this kind of flip-flopping, this, and sometimes we can't explain it. You know, the night before, we think, in the morning when I wake up, I'm going to meditate first thing. And then when we wake up the next morning, what happens? For some reason. Yeah, there's something else that's more pressing, you know. It's just, we can't explain it. And one way we can explain it is that, well, we lack some integration. we lack enough continuity of purpose in our lives to commit ourselves to following what our aspirations are, our good intentions. And sometimes we can do it, and sometimes we can't. And that's just the way that it is. So, you know, this is the second fetter to break through to enlightenment or to stream entry. So we're not alone in this tendency. So in relation to the group, we can say that in this way we are at mercy of the group. It's much easier to go along with what the group wants or to be an individualist and just resist and complain about the group. So the individualist reaps his identity from being different from the group, but never commits to anything. And the conformist can only commit to what the group is expecting. So the third fetter, then, is more related to our social conditioning and also our spiritual lives. We relate to moral rules and rites and rituals as ends in themselves rather than as means to an end. So we accept conventional morality without thinking it through for ourselves, without thinking, you know, we follow the rules or not, whichever. But we don't consider the fact that, well, maybe some rules or laws might need to be changed. Maybe they don't conform to a kind of natural morality. So being aware of that difference between conventional morality and natural morality would fit in here. Relating to rites and rituals as ends in themselves, in our spiritual lives, we take on spiritual practices and teachings, sometimes as dogma or as activities that are expected of us. We may have the attitude that doing these things will get us what we want, will get us enlightened, or will get us accepted by this group of people at the Buddhist Center. So we have to always look at our motives, and having mixed motives is very common and natural. But it is a wrong view to be looking at our practices as ends in themselves, because these things are not ends in themselves. They are not going to cause enlightenment to arise. They are beneficial things, but we can't become dependent on them or rigid in relation to them. We can only see them as means to the ultimate goal. All right, now I want to go into more about what this group is that I've been talking about. Let's just brainstorm a little bit what groups we are involved with. What are some of the groups that are... society is structured around family,
work.
Religion.
Gender.
Politics.
Social economic.
Social economic groups.
Sexual identity.
What was the last one?
Race.
Yep. Schools. Other organizations.
Age.
Yeah. Age groups. Nations. Governments. States. The Buddhist Center. Okay. So Sangharakshita makes this very strong statement that the group is the enemy of the individual. because it works against awareness. So the individual needs, he says the individual needs protection from the group. Because the group exists for its own survival. Its job is to perpetuate itself. And those who get caught up in this group development, group perpetuation, could say group mind, collective habit, well, those of us who get caught up in that will have a difficult time becoming more self-aware. So the group came first before the true individual. The family, the tribe, the group was and is necessary for survival. Eventually, groups got larger and larger, like nations. And then some groups got smaller and smaller, like nuclear families. So the small groups became susceptible to being more neurotic, and large groups to being too unwieldy. So today, we have groups that are neurotic and groups that are unwieldy that we have to relate to that weren't in existence a number of eons before. But whether big or small, a group is organized for its own survival, and the interests of the individual have to be subordinated to the group in order for the group to survive. The group also is a power structure. On the other hand, it's made possible the emergence of civilization and higher levels of culture. So the group has been valuable and necessary. But the pitfall of the group is the price that's usually paid by the individual in its relationship to the group. And as I said before, that price is conformity or adversity. So some groups are positive groups and some are negative groups. And this is a distinction that Sangharakshita has made. Negative groups are made up of people who are not very self-conscious and do not consider the fact that they can change, kind of just go along with the status quo. Extreme example of this is the caste system in India. Closer to home, most of us have had the experience of our family being a negative group. As an individual, when I'm with my family of origin, I have to work really hard to keep my awareness and not slip into habitual and unskillful ways of being. So we can say that the family can sometimes be a negative group. The positive group is what the FWBO, for instance, strives to be, what the San Francisco Buddhist Center is and strives to be. It's a collective of people who are aspiring individuals and who are aware of the pitfalls of the group and can guard against them and are assisting each other in the development of the spiritual community. They are developing this reflexive consciousness or this awareness of being aware. So another kind of little personal story. I came across this lecture by Bhante where he was outlining, one of the lectures where he was outlining the individual and the group. It was at a very pivotal time in my spiritual life. I had been an unaffiliated Buddhist for 8 years before I found the FWBO. And I had several friends who were spiritual friends and mentors. And I looked to them for guidance and pointers on the path. And we were all inspired by the writings of Lama Govinda. And a couple of those friends had personal contact with him before he died. He was living in California at that time in Mill Valley. But he's German. He was German, and he started up a group in Germany years before. But in the late 70s, 80s, when he was living here in California, he felt that his followers really weren't ready for a group. They weren't ready to have an organized group. And his feeling was that being a part of the group would not be helpful and would hinder the spiritual progress of his followers. My friends agreed with that, and when I told them about the FWBO after I had found out about it, and they were pretty skeptical and discouraging. And one of them said, actually, that the last thing the Bay Area needs is another so-called spiritual McDonald's franchise. That's how strongly they felt about it. Because I had already started a little small meditation group down in Palo Alto. So anyway, I went to New Hampshire in August of 1988 to check out the FWBO close up. I went to Ariloka Retreat Center there, and I was there for 3 weeks. And the first, one of the first few days I was there, there was another visit. There was a visiting order member there who was leading, facilitating the study on Bhante's lectures, taped lectures. And so this was one of the first tapes that, it's probably the first tape, I think, that we studied that morning. And I was just blown away by it, because here was a teacher who had taken the risk of starting up a group and was warning his followers that it was dangerous and that we had to stay awake and keep it new and fresh and dynamic. So I was very impressed with this idea of the group as a practice. And obviously I'm still here to tell the tale, 19 years later. So the Buddha's teaching is concerned with the individual alone and the individual in association with others. His Dharma shows individuals how to grow, how to develop awareness, how to develop emotional positivity, and to live spontaneously and creatively, and how to be responsible. The Buddha, of course, was a true individual in the highest sense, an enlightened individual. And the Buddha realized that he had to go forth from the group. He realized that he had to go forth from his family and the material pleasures that he was experiencing in the palace where he was living, because he saw that people were suffering. And he felt compelled to find the solution to this problem of perpetual human suffering. So he became a spiritual seeker, a wanderer, and he was eventually able to see the truth. Sangharakshita says that from that moment when the Buddha saw the truth, we may say that the power of the group was diminished and the power of the gravitational pull of conditioned existence was diminished. Because the Buddha saw the cycle of birth and death, and he saw the conditioned stages of suffering, and he saw a way out. Sangharakshita says there's only a spiritual solution to the problem of the imbalance between the individual and the group. It is the philosophy, the perspective, and the actions of the individual that must change. And then the spiritual community can be possible. So what is the spiritual community, and how is it different from the group? So the spiritual community is not a group. In that same sense, it's not an organization. It has no center. It is a gathering of friends who are individuals. The purposes of the spiritual community are very different from those of the group. They are twofold. Its members help one another to develop spiritually, and they help others outside the community to develop their individuality. The individuals in this community have regular personal contact with one another. They have a common spiritual ideal, and a common means of realizing that aim. They are walking in the same direction on the same path. So this is what going for refuge is about. Going for refuge to the three jewels, which is the Buddha, or the ideal of enlightenment, the Dharma, the path of the Buddha's teaching, or the truth, we could say. And then the spiritual community itself is the third jewel. So the spiritual community cannot be a group. because we cannot go for refuge to a group. The individuals within the community are friends in the sense that they're all going for refuge. And they may also like each other, but they especially, and they definitely like what the others in the community like, and that is the Dharma. They're drawn to the Dharma. So without friendship of this kind, the spiritual community would not exist. Spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life, said the Buddha. But I'm not going to say anything more about friendship because our next series, in a few weeks, we'll be spending 6 weeks on looking at what spiritual friendship is. So when the spiritual community becomes too large, Sangharakshita says, it starts to feel the gravitational pull of the group and it tends to take on those characteristics. As it does, it degenerates. And we've seen this in religious groups time and time again, with the degeneration, the institutionalization of what started out as a small collection of, gathering of people. So he says that you can't have a worldwide spiritual community. It's interesting because we have a worldwide order called the Western Buddhist Order. But there's no centralization to this worldwide community. It consists of small communities around the world. It has no central core and or organization to it, really. It's a network of friends whose center is wherever a group of order members gathers. Okay, now coming to the end here, I want to look just a moment at our relationship to this positive group that we are involved with to a greater or lesser extent. Right here, the San Francisco Buddhist Center is a positive group which is moving in the direction of a spiritual community. There's a core of group of committed individuals or aspiring individuals who keep this center afloat. And what does it take to do that? Well, there are all kinds of tasks, duties that have to be done because this is an organization. The order is not an organization, but the San Francisco Buddhist Center is an organization. And we have this building and we need to keep it clean. We need to keep the lights on. We need to raise funds. There are clerical duties, administrative duties, finance and bookkeeping and so on. And most of these duties are done on a volunteer basis. So we are very fortunate here to be operating on a balanced budget and to be offering an interesting array of classes, retreats, and events. This happens only with a great deal of commitment and vision. And underlying all of this is the individual spiritual practices of the people who are doing this work. It wouldn't be effective without that, the exemplification of spiritual practice, meditation, including mindfulness and metta and self-reflection, ethical and altruistic action, friendship, compassion, and wisdom. So this very place offers an opportunity for collective spiritual practice, not only by coming here and listening and discussing once a week, but working together is also a practice for a number of us. Those of us involved in running things here have benefited immensely by this. Our relationships with each other and the ways we get to know each other in this positive group arena. And the opportunities for stretching and challenging our habitual tendencies as we work in groups. All of this is possible in a setting which promotes awareness, encourages people to try out being different. So it's worth thinking about how you do relate to the San Francisco Buddhist Center and how you could relate to it, perhaps in a more active way even. So I just put that out there for you to think about. We are always needing more people to volunteer and do things around here, but we also don't expect it of you. So I'm not saying this as a an expectation, but just Since we're looking at our lives as individuals in relation to groups and how spiritual communities can rise and grow out of a positive group such as this, it's worth thinking about. So I have some other questions for our discussion groups, which I'll give to the discussion group leaders. Thank you.